Boyd. Up next on the best of Think 2020, the healing power we hold with the way we breathe.
By taking control of how we bring in those 30 pounds of air every day into our lungs and out of our lungs, allows us to control so many functions of our bodies. We can't control our liver function, our kidneys, our hearts, but we can control our breathing. And when we control our breathing, we can greatly influence all these other systems in our bodies and bring us back into balance.
This hour, we'll talk about the correct and incorrect ways to breathe and the many effects these practices have on our bodies. That's after a short break. Asleep or awake, paying attention or not, our autonomic nervous system ensures we keep breathing 24/7, which is not the same as optimizing that exchange of oxygen and carbon dioxide. Is it possible we're doing it wrong more than 20,000 times a day? From KERA in Dallas, this is the best of Think 2020, a look back at some of our favorite shows of the year. I'm Chris Boyd. Many ancient peoples paid close attention to how respiration made them feel and how deliberate variations in breath might deliver benefits. As my guest has learned, modern science is just catching up to the remarkable ways breathing plays into emotional health, metabolism, immune function, sleep, even good posture. Journalist James Nestor writes for publications including Outside Magazine, Scientific American, The Atlantic, and The New York Times. He joined me in May to talk about his book, Breath, The New Science of a Lost Art. In that conversation, I have to say Nestor opened my eyes to the power that breathing has to change our sleep, our health, our mood. They're concepts that can apply to anyone. I mean, we all breathe, right? I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I did. We'll learn how small changes in something as simple as breathing can lead to better quality of life. James, welcome back to Think.
Thanks so much for having me.
You note that when we go to the doctor, somebody checks our heart rate, our temperature, our blood pressure. They ask about sleep and diet and whether we're experiencing pain. But unless we're there for a specific problem like a cough or congestion, we're never asked about how we are breathing. What kind of opportunity are doctors missing out on?
I think they're missing out on a huge opportunity, because how we breathe affects our blood pressure that they just took. It affects our moods. It affects our metabolism. It affects our respiratory health and even our posture, as you had mentioned. So there's this huge gray zone that no one's really been peering into in the medical community. It's the preventative power and the use of breathing. A lot of pulmonologists look at breathing, but they're looking at pathologies. They're cutting out cancers. They're dealing with emphysema or pneumonia. But it's teaching yourself how to breathe properly so you never get those problems to begin with is really the key to so much of health. And this is something that ancient people have known for thousands and thousands of years.
Okay, I'm going to anticipate all the skeptics out there asking, if breathing happens without us thinking about it all the time, how is it possible we're doing it wrong?
Well, we are able to breathe autonomically for a reason. So we don't have to, we can focus on other things. And the ability to take conscious control of breathing is something that really makes humans very unique in the animal kingdom. Other animals have this. Dolphins, for instance, always breathe consciously. But by taking control of how we bring in those 30 pounds of air every day into our lungs and out of our lungs allows us to control so many functions of our bodies. We can't control our liver function, our kidneys, or our hearts, but we can control our breathing. And when we control our breathing, we can greatly influence all these other systems in our bodies and bring us back into balance.
So many people snore. I was really surprised to read that it's really common, but it's never normal.
It's not. I mean, if you think about it, there's some dogs that snore. There's a few birds that snore. But for the vast majority of the animal kingdom, the 5,400 different mammals on the planet, so few of them snore. And there's some convincing evidence suggesting that humans are snoring now, like 50% of us snore now. And there's pretty good evidence showing that we weren't doing this 200, 300, 400, 500 years ago because the skeletature of our faces has changed so much. So snoring isn't so much tied to anxiety or a psychological problem. It's tied to an anatomical problem. We've changed so much that it's hard even to take a breath in and out, especially at night.
So disevolution stacked the deck against us. Explain how and why that happened.
Yeah, so when I first started researching this book about 3 years ago, I thought I had a pretty good idea of the leaders in the field, what areas I was going to be exploring, and I was pretty comfortable with how I was approaching this until I got thrown a complete curveball about 6 months in, had to throw out all my other research. So when I talked to a biological anthropologist, whom I was connected to by a friend of a friend, and she gave me a modern human skull. This was in her lab, and she showed me how crooked the teeth are. She said, "This is extremely common for us. About 90% of us have crooked teeth. But if you take a skull that's 500 years old, there's a very good chance it's going to have perfectly straight teeth. And that's true for a skull that's 5,000 years old and 50,000 years old and on back, 500,000 years old." So only in the past about 400, 500 years have humans had chronically crooked teeth. And she said, "Why is that?" I said, "Oh, it must be genetics or something," but which is totally false. So there's a problem with having crooked teeth. It's because our mouths are so small that our teeth are not able to grow in straight. So they grow in crooked. So we need extractions. We need to remove our wisdom teeth, which is extremely unnatural. But there's another issue beyond just aesthetics and having to wear braces. It's a mouth that's too small for its teeth is too small to breathe comfortably through. So our airways have gotten smaller. And this is one reason why we have so many of these chronic respiratory problems: snoring, sleep apnea, asthma, some elements of COPD, on and on and on. And this was a story that I had no idea existed. As in high school and in college, I was taught that evolution always works in the straight line forward, survival of the fittest. Totally false. Evolution means change. Animals can change for the better or the worse. And as far as humans are concerned, our breathing has definitely changed for the worse.
So why did our discovery of fire and cooked food, this is much before 500 years ago, but why did our discovery of those things and our acquisition of the ability to speak start us down the road to making our breathing worse?
There were really two big things that happened. So about 1.5 million years ago, maybe 1.7 million years ago, we started processing food. What I mean by that is we started bashing prey against rocks and tenderizing meat. And this tenderized meat was much easier to digest. So it allowed us to have many more calories. And with those extra calories, we grew a larger brain. That brain needed real estate, so it took it from the front of our faces. Then about 800,000 years ago, we started processing food in fire, which released even more calories, not only for meat, but for other foods. And so that brain grew even larger and took more room away. Then about 60,000 years ago, our larynx started sinking in our throats, either to accommodate speech or it started sinking, and that allowed us to really have complex communication. We could speak louder and have more control over our tongues and words. But the problem is with that, with a lower larynx, you have more room for the tongue to fall back. So other animals don't have this problem. So humans became the only animals in the whole animal kingdom that could easily choke on food and die. And so that is related to sleep apnea. And then finally, in this long line of evolution, about 400 years ago, 300 years ago, we started massively processing food. So removing the bran and the germ from rice and from flour and wheat. So we're eating this very, very soft processed food. So all the change that happened before 400 years ago happened gradually, tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of years, and we could adapt to it just fine. But the changes that started about 400 years ago, we have not been able to catch up with it. And that's one reason why we're breathing so poorly now.
Okay, so that's evolution, which happens over many hundreds of generations and thousands of years. You learned that breathing a lot through our mouths literally changes our bodies within days.
That's right. So we've known for a long time that mouth breathing is bad news, right? So you're taking in this unfiltered, unhumidified, unconditioned air into your lungs. It annoys the lungs. You can get more allergies this way. You can exacerbate asthma, on and on and on. It's much less efficient to breathe through your mouth. You're getting less oxygen than breathing through the nose. But we didn't know how soon this damage came on. So I was talking to the chief of rhinology research at Stanford over several months. And I mentioned, I said, has anyone ever tested this? Have we looked at how quickly mouth breathing can damage someone? He said, well, of course not, because that would be unethical to bring some subjects in and say, we're going to damage you. And then, we're going to heal you on the way out. So I said, I'll do it. I'll sign up. I'll volunteer for this. So I got another person, a breathing therapist, one of the best breathers in the world. And I said, what would happen when we make him a mouth breather, So both of us took part in this awful study for 10 days. We had silicone up our noses so we could only breathe through our mouths. And the effects were so immediate and so dramatic. I mean, even thinking of this is making me anxious. We immediately started snoring. Neither of us were snoring before. We started snoring right off the bat, first day. Within 3 days, we were snoring through half the night, both of us. We both got sleep apnea. We both got extremely anxious. Our cortisol levels were through the roof. We were stressed out. I mean, I could go, athletic endurance plummeted. I could go on and on and on. It's very bad. But the good news about all of this is the next 10 days, where we removed those silicone plugs and tried to breathe only through our noses, all of our snoring disappeared. All of our sleep apnea disappeared. Stress levels disappeared. Heart rate variability, which is a measure of autonomic nervous system function, skyrocketed, which is a good thing. So it was very obvious that the ancients were onto something, right? For thousands of years, they've been saying, do not breathe through your mouth, always breathe through the nose. And I think we added credence to those old claims.
Of course, lots of people can't breathe through their noses because of allergies or some problem that they have within the structure of their nose. I mean, do tons of people walking around need some kind of medical intervention?
A lot of people do. So some people have so many problems with their noses that they will need surgical intervention. And, I'm not a breathing therapist. I'm not a doctor. I'm not here to diagnose anyone. But I will say, having been in this field for a number of years and talked to so many clinicians, that a lot of people who have these chronic problems are not using their nose enough. And the less we use the nose, the less we're going to be able to use the nose. A Stanford breathing therapist told me that she had looked at 200 people who had laryngectomies, who had a hole drilled in their throat for one reason or the other because they couldn't breathe through their mouth or nose. She found between 2 months and 2 years, all of them had complete obstruction in their noses.
Wow.
So she happened to be a mouth breather as well. She's like, I wake up in the middle of the night, my mouth was dry. So she was slated for surgery, but she thought, huh, I wonder if I just sort of force myself to breathe through my nose, what would happen? She completely healed herself within a few weeks. And now she is a habitual nose breather. So hearing that from someone at Stanford really changed my mind about the potential of the human body to heal itself, which I just want to make clear again, this does not mean everyone can heal themselves, but I think a very large population, by taking some simple steps, can really feel a massive improvement and be able to nasal breathe.
Some scientists have used breathing to correct scoliosis.
Yeah, so this is another one of those things that you never really expect when you start researching a book on breathing. But I found some medical literature from about 100 years ago that this teenager in Germany had very severe scoliosis. She was given, a bed and a wheelchair and said, there you go. You're going to stay here the rest of your life. But she had different views about the human body's potential. So she started doing something called orthopedic breathing, where she would curve her body in a certain way, breathe into one lung, curve it in the other way, breathe into the other lung. Within a few years, she had breathed her spine perfectly straight. So she then went on and started showing hundreds and hundreds of other women how to do this. People that the hospitals had given up on, who had 80 degrees of scoliosis, which is extremely extreme, very, very difficult. These people, many couldn't walk, they couldn't look up, and the x-rays were so stunning.
I'm Chris Boyd, and you're listening back to the best of Think 2020. My guest is James Nestor, author of Breath, The New Science of a Lost Art. When we come back, how changing the way we breathe can treat many common mental and physical ailments.
Just looking at her studies and looking at simply breathing slowly, keeping that CO2 at the right level, can abate so many symptoms of panic, anxiety, and asthma, and much more beyond that.
That's after a short break. This is the best of Think 2020. I'm Chris Boyd. We're listening back to my conversation with James Nestor. He's a journalist who joined me in May to talk about his book, Breath, The New Science of Lost Art. Let's return to the conversation. James, how does breathing play into the body's production of energy?
Well, we have two ways of producing energy in the body, either anaerobically or aerobically. And anaerobically just uses sugar. So we don't need oxygen to produce energy that way. And this is actually how the very first cells on Earth were producing energy. So aerobic energy uses oxygen and sugars and glucose. So it turns out that aerobic energy is 15 to 16 times more efficient. You get that much more out of burning aerobically instead of anaerobically. So this is a very important thing to keep our bodies burning aerobically and to keep the circulation up. But what I've found is unhealthy breathing habits, especially breathing too much, can turn your body to so many of those cells to start burning anaerobically, which is really bad news because a lot of people think that by breathing more, by opening their mouth and really getting air in, they're bringing more oxygen into their bodies, but they are not. They're doing the opposite. So this is such a contrarian concept. It took me months and months of studying and talking to experts to get my head around it. But it's true. Slow breathing and oftentimes breathing less will give you more oxygen and more energy.
Yeah, so most of us sort of understand the importance of breathing as being all about the oxygen, right? Carbon dioxide gets this bad rap because it's the junk we breathe out when we exhale. It's not that simple. You explain here that we also need carbon dioxide. What does it do for us?
Yeah, and this was research that was really uncovered about 100 years ago. They found that oxygen will disassociate from our hemoglobin. I won't get too technical into this. Where there is carbon dioxide. So the way, if you're working out, if you're lifting weights with your right arm and you feel that like heat and that stinging in that arm, that is a buildup of carbon dioxide, which is sending messages for more oxygen to go there and feed those muscles and to feed those cells. So some researchers at Yale were saying carbon dioxide is of equal importance in our bodies. And we found that to be 100% true. We need that balance of CO2 and O2 to operate properly. And so many times you hear about how CO2 is this awful thing. It's, you know, cause of climate change and acidity in the ocean. 100% true. But CO2 in the body, the right balance of it is essential to be healthy. And it's so the idea that, you know, you should just constantly be breathing out and getting rid of all that CO2. This is what I was always told in my gyms that I attended. That's not true. So there is an unhealthy amount of CO2 with people like emphysema who can't exhale fully. That's bad news. But the key is to have that balance. And so many of us, especially people with anxieties, with asthma, other respiratory problems, have too little CO2. And that's one of the reasons that they're suffering from these issues.
So there are people with asthma who have learned different breathing techniques and kept their disease in better control.
One of the most fascinating studies I found was from a local researcher to you at SMU, mm-hmm. Alicia Murette. And she was studying how levels of CO2 affected both panic and asthma. And so she gave asthmatics this capnometer, which you breathe into and it shows you how much CO2 is in your exhaled breath. And she found if these people were able to keep their CO2 at a healthy level, they had significantly less asthma attacks. And it also worked for panic because both of these populations traditionally have very low CO2. And they have that because they breathe too much. If you're constantly breathing, you are off gassing too much CO2. The key is to, one of the keys to breathing slowly is it allows you to have that proper balance of CO2. And so just looking at her studies and looking at simply breathing slowly, keeping that CO2 at the right level can abate so many symptoms of panic, anxiety, and asthma, and much more beyond that.
Okay, so there are these sometimes fancy spas or gyms or boutiques offer oxygen bars, right, where you breathe in pure oxygen, maybe scented with like mango or rhubarb or whatever. Is that going to do us any good if we don't have an oxygen deficiency going in?
Yeah, this is something that really shocked me as well. Is I've been to a few of those at airports and international travel. You feel terrible. I'm like, oh,
that's what, man, I need, right?
Pure oxygen is going to set me up. Nothing is happening. So pure oxygen for someone who is critically ill will do wonders, mm-hmm. right? Who doesn't have the ability to exchange all that gas in their lungs. Someone with emphysema, absolutely pure oxygen is really going to help them. For a healthy body, it's going to do nothing. And there's some evidence that suggests it could possibly harm us more than help us. And so this is so antithetical to what we think. I mean, you look at the sidelines of a football game. Sometimes they give the quarterback, you know, an oxygen tank to huff a few huffs of oxygen. They don't need any more oxygen. A healthy body is going to have 98, you know, 97% oxygen. Breathing pure oxygen might bump that up 1% or 2%. But that oxygen has nowhere to go unless you have healthy levels of CO2 in your body. You're just going to breathe it back out. So talk about a waste. You pay $50 to inhale this stuff, and you're just breathing it back out.
So it's like peeing out extra vitamins that you take in a supplement.
Yeah, you could say it's like taking, you know, 10,000 milligrams of vitamin C and thinking you're going to stave off a cold. The real key to breathing is to use what you've got, not to always want to get more and more, but to use what you have efficiently. And that's what slow breathing does. You know, we breathe out 3/4 of the oxygen we breathe in when we're breathing normally. So if you're breathing faster and faster, you're not metabolizing any of that oxygen. You're just breathing it back out. And slow breathing and nasal breathing allows you to absorb 20% more oxygen than you would through the mouth or by breathing quickly. So just doing that, you don't need an oxygen bar to do this. We've got this wonderful technology within us. It's called our nose and our lungs, and anyone can do this. And it's really as simple as that. And a lot of people, you know, I've met over the years say, no, it can't be as simple as that because the medicine here that's being prescribed is air. They can't think that air can do all this stuff. But once you start thinking about 25,000 times a day, 30 pounds a day, how you ingest that air, how you take that in, makes a world of difference.
So our faces are pretty symmetrical, right? Two eyes, two ears, two nostrils. Each nostril has a different job?
Yeah, this is another very strange thing that I stumbled upon. But it turns out that our nostrils are covered with erectile tissue. And this is the same tissue in the genitals and elsewhere. And our noses are more closely connected to our genitals than any other organ. So when one gets excited or inflamed, the other responds. So much so that some people have too close of a connection and they have this syndrome called honeymoon rhinitis, where once they start getting stimulated, they start sneezing uncontrollably. But
wow.
Most of us, pretty unfortunate scenario there, but most of us don't have that close. But what was interesting to me is to learn that this erectile tissue on both sides of our nostrils is going to flex and open and close at different times of the day. So our bodies will instinctively open the right nostril for about 30 minutes to 3 hours and then close it and let the left nostril open, like flowers, you know, looking at sunlight and closing it at nighttime. And many researchers believe we do this because when we breathe through the right nostril, we are sending more air. We're stimulating more of the left side of the brain. This is the logical side of the brain. We are speeding up our metabolism. We're heating up our bodies. We're speeding up our hearts. So it has a stimulating effect. When we breathe through the left nostril, it's stimulating the right side of the brain, more closely associated with creative thought. So we're cooling the body. We're slowing the heartbeat. So we're relaxing ourselves. So it's fascinating to me to think that our bodies are using our noses like a HVAC system, right? To moderate our different moods and to respond to it. And we know that when people get sick, our nostrils, this back and forth baffling of air increases. So it's probably trying to, our bodies are trying to find balance that way. So just something to think about whenever you're breathing next. Your nostrils have a mind of their own, and they're controlling aspects of your health just by bringing in and exhaling air.
So can you deliberately manipulate that by holding one nostril closed and breathing through one side or the other?
You certainly can. There's a whole school of yoga dedicated to this. We call it alternate nostril breathing. And so let's say you are really stressed out and you want to calm yourself, have creative thought. You can just plug your right nostril, which I'm doing right now, and you can inhale through the left and exhale through the left, and inhale through the left. And there's a zillion different hacks you can do with alternate nostril breathing. You can look them up online. And so the key that I've found where I think it's most beneficial is to also just create that balance in your body. So yogis do something after they eat, they lean on their left side to create more heat and open up their right nostril because they believe having more heat in the body is going to allow you to digest food more easily. So you can, try various means of doing this. And what I thought was so interesting is there's science and dozens of studies to back up so much of this stuff.
This was interesting to me too. I think a lot of people are aware that, ancient practices like yoga and certain kinds of meditation focus on breath. It turns out religious rituals that don't mention breathing may offer similar benefits. What did you learn about the rosary, which is this series of repeated prayers used by Catholics?
So about 20 years ago, some Italian researchers took a group of subjects and they had them recite the rosary, the Catholic prayer cycle of Ave Maria, in the original Latin. And this is dictated by a priest and it's a call and response. The priest says a phrase, the congregation says a phrase, and back and forth. And then they had them all recite the Om Mani Padme Hum, which is one of the most famous Buddhist chants, Buddhist mantras. And they found that the amount of time it took to recite each of these prayers, the amount it took to exhale, because you're exhaling when you're vocalization, when you're vocalizing, was 5.5 seconds. And then that gave you about 5.5 seconds to take an inhale. So they thought, oh, wow, this is very interesting that both of these very famous prayers were using the same system of breathing. Not only that, but they found it in Kundalini yoga with a Sa Ta Na Ma, very famous chant, and also with the Om, that's about 5.5 to 6 seconds, 5.5 to 6 seconds in, back in, and out again. And so prayers throughout thousands of years have all had this same time code to them. So when they were looking at the subjects, when they were reciting these prayers and breathing this way, they found that their brains got way more oxygen, and more importantly, their bodies were able to enter the state of coherence where everything worked in perfect synchrony with one another. So when you're breathing this slow and you're exhaling and breathing again, you're engaging more of the diaphragm. The diaphragm is this muscle organ that lifts the lungs when we exhale and lowers when we inhale. The diaphragm is considered a second heart because when we inhale and exhale, we are also moving blood into the thoracic cavity. So the diaphragm assists the heart in circulation. And by using more of it, engaging more of it, we're able to lessen the burden of the heart. And that's one of the reasons that slow breathing is so effective for monitoring blood pressure. If someone's got a blood pressure monitor right now, try to take your blood pressure and then spend about 5 minutes breathing in about 5 to 6 seconds, breathing out about 5 to 6 seconds through your nose, and then take your blood pressure after those 5 minutes. I've found that I've been able to decrease my blood pressure 10, 15, even 20 points simply by changing the way I was breathing.
You're listening to the best of Think 2020. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, I want to go to the phones. Luke is on the line in Plano, Texas. Hi, Luke.
Hi, yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Mr. Nestor, as you discussed slow breathing and balanced breathing, I was curious if in your research if you investigated the Wim Hof method, which is essentially the hyperventilating for a set number of breaths and then holding the breath and repeating those cycles, which is supposedly to increase energy, reduce stress, and augment immune response to deal with pathogens. So I'm just curious if you investigated any of the hyperventilating type breathing along with the other breathings.
Thanks for calling.
Sure. So I set up the book in sort of three stages. The beginning of the book talks about the problems, why we're breathing so poorly. A lot of the skull problems of the anthropologies at the beginning. Then in the middle, I look at just establishing healthy breathing habits. Anyone can do these things. And it explains the science and the what and the where these things came from, all of the researchers looking at it. And the last third, I was able to have some fun. So it's like, after you've established these healthy breathing patterns, what is it like to really push breathing to that next level up? And I call these breathing patterns breathing plus. And so I spent a ton of time with TUMO researchers. That is the version of breath work that Wim Hof uses. And what this is, and the caller was exactly right on with this, you breathe extremely fast for about 30 breaths, hold your breath for about a minute, minute and a half, take one huge breath, and then breathe very fast again. So this sounds like a really bad idea, right? Because you are absolutely stressing the body out, which is exactly the point. So what you're doing is our bodies nowadays, especially during this pandemic, we're constantly half stressed, half relaxed, we're anxious. What this breathing method does is it focuses that stress on a 15, 20 minute session. So you stress yourself out specifically so the other 23 and a half hours of the day, you can be relaxed. And luckily there's been a ton of science that's looked into how effective this breathing and other versions of TUMO and pranayama are that are very similar to this breathing. And they've found that people, especially people with autoimmune problems, which is caused by the immune system going rogue and attacking healthy tissues in the body, they can abate so many symptoms of autoimmune issues just by taking control of their breathing and by establishing that harmony between the nervous systems. And I know this sounds impossible. Like, of course we can't, you know, take control of our nervous system. It's called autonomic for a reason. That's false. Hmm. We can also take control of our immune systems, and that's what they're finding in studies right now.
I'm Chris Boyd. You're listening to the Best of Think 2020. My guest is James Nestor, author of Breath, The New Science of a Lost Art. When we come back, why breathing better doesn't necessarily require professional assistance.
These are breathing practices anyone can do. They're going to be breathing slowly, breathing with focused breaths, big exhale, breathing less. Like, these are things that anyone can benefit from.
That's when Think continues. This is the Best of Think 2020. I'm Chris Boyd. We're listening back to my conversation with James Nestor. He's a journalist who joined me in May to talk about his book, Breath, The New Science of Lost Art. Let's return to the conversation. I want to go back to the diaphragm, which you mentioned a few minutes ago, James. All the singers and actors I know are always going on and on about the diaphragm. I work in FM radio, so I don't have to project. I'm not ever sure if I'm really using my diaphragm or not, or at least using it properly. How can we know that we are breathing using the diaphragm, and what's a good way to get in this habit?
Well, I think the key is to engage more of the diaphragm more often. And this is obviously something that singers are tuned into because that's how they're able to project this way. The easiest way of doing this, and it seems so simple again, is to take these slow breaths in and these slow breaths out. What I found so interesting was that In the 1950s, there was a vocal teacher, a choral teacher, who taught his students how to engage more of their diaphragms. And he got so famous and so good at teaching students that the Met Opera started employing him. But then, after a few years after that, he was asked by the VA hospitals on the East Coast to help emphysemics. So these are people who have very little diaphragmatic movement. They just, that's how they breathe. And simply by showing them how to engage their diaphragms, he was able to allow these people who had been bedridden for years and years to walk out of the hospital and live normal lives. And again, this is one of these subjects that just seems too impossible to be true, but there are reams of data, there's films, there's documentation showing just what a massive effect simply moving your diaphragm, maybe even 15 to 20% more than you are right now, what that does for blood pressure and so much else. So the simplest thing, again, you know, you can get more into this and do yoga, which stretches that rib cage and allows you to take those deeper breaths more easily. Or what this researcher, Carl Stau, did was he would have his patients take a breath in and then count from 1 to 10, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 9, 10, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 9, 10, on and on, and keep doing that until you're whispering, never pushing it too far, just being very calm and soft about it. And he found that doing this allowed someone who was bedridden to have the same diaphragmatic movement and the same exercise as someone who would be jogging. So he was conditioning their lungs as though they were exercising. So, and I get into that in the book, and this is something that I see so many people starting to talk about, diaphragmatic movement, how essential that is to respiratory health.
What is the right way for us to be breathing under ordinary circumstances? Is it that 5.5 seconds per inhale and exhale? That feels a little slow for every day, but I honestly don't know.
Yeah, so that is when the body is happiest, when you're getting the perfect amount of O2, you have the perfect levels of CO2, you're in the state of calm. But is that realistic to walk around and to force yourself to do this 24 hours a day? No, it's not. Even though I try to do it as often as I can, I fail often. So the key with these exercises is to acclimate your body and condition it to breathe more slowly and breathe exactly in line with your metabolic needs. So you're not going to want to breathe 5 or 6 times a minute if you're out jogging, right? Your metabolic needs go up. But I think the real benefit of these practices is to increase your tolerance of CO2 so that you'll be naturally, unconsciously able to breathe slowly and fluidly and not even think about it. The point is to just be able to do this and not have timers and not have pulse oximeters on your fingers, but to program your brain to know that this is the proper way of breathing. And, you know, I have seen people absolutely transform by adopting simple breathing habits. And this is something confirmed by psychiatrists, and pulmonologists, and on and on.
All right. Let's take a call now from Plano, Texas. We have Kumar on the line. Hi, Kumar.
Hi, Chris. I listen to your show every day. I
oh,
love it.
Thanks.
You're a wonderful interviewer.
Thank you.
For the guest on the show, I guess I've got two separate thoughts. One is regarding snoring. If I understood your guest correctly, the prevalence of snoring is on the rise, and I feel like that's something I'm witnessing in my day-to-day life as well. I snore a lot. My girlfriend does. My dad does. So any reason why the incidence of snoring is on the rise? When I ask my GP about it, he says it's probably allergies or sinus infections, and I don't think it's the case. And my second thought is, I'm Indian. My dad is from Tamil Nadu, and he does the yoga meditation breathwork practice. But he's probably the number one offender of snoring like a freight train. He's always snored ever since we were children. And he's been doing yoga for almost 35 years now, and he still snores. I'm not as big a follower of it, but I do have pretty good breathwork because I'm a long-distance runner, been training, et cetera, and I snore too. So I guess two questions. One, the prevalence of snoring, and two, does yoga really help with snoring, or does it just give you additional lung capacity?
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, great, great question. So snoring is caused by the soft tissues at the back of the throat, right? So one thing that happens is we start losing bone mass when we grow older. So with less bone to hold on to, these soft tissues can sag more, which is one of the reasons why as we get older, we start snoring more. So one of the things that the humans are not doing, and we haven't been doing for the past 400 years, is chewing food. If you think about even the healthiest foods right now, avocado, a smoothie, you know, a chia seed drink, It's all soft. And we have evolved to be grinding away on stuff for 4 hours a day, right? That's what our ancestors were doing. And now hardly any of us chew at all. So they've done studies where they've taken infants and looked at infants who have been breastfed versus those who have been bottle fed. Breastfeeding requires a ton of stress on the mouth. So a lot of chewing and stress. And they found that those infants who have been breastfed have significantly lower incidences of snoring later on in life. So it's by exercising the mouth and the throat respond to just like any other muscle. So by chewing, you can tone up those soft tissues. I can't tell you that it's absolutely going to work for you because a lot of this also stems from us having too small of a mouth nowadays, right? But I do know that people have transformed their snoring, their sleep apnea by adopting some simple practices. And one thing that I've done that I have felt incredible change from is, and I know this sounds like pseudoscience, so I have to spend a second here to back it up, but is to use something called mouth tape. And I heard about this from that Stanford breathing therapist. So I, you know, considered it a little more seriously than I would otherwise. And this is taking a very small, teeny piece of tape and just putting it in the middle of your lips at night. The point is not to inhibit you from breathing out of your mouth. It's to train your mouth shut. Because by breathing through the nose, you may still snore, but you'll be training those tissues at the back of your throat to tone up a lot more than breathing through the mouth. If you're breathing through the mouth every single night, those tissues move forward. When you breathe through the nose, those tissues can move back. So, you know, there's a number of reasons why we snore today, and there are a number of fixes. But I've found personally with about five people, I conducted my own little weird study because I'm weird and I do this stuff. And I haven't published this anywhere because I was just curious. I said, just try this. These are people who have habitually been snoring for 20, 30 years. I said, use this tape, record your snoring, send me all the info the next day. And 4 out of 5 of those people are no longer snoring by this stupid little piece of tape that they wear at night. So I've seen that studies right now, Stanford is now booting up a huge study. They're trying to get funding for it, very hard to do in this time of 500 people and looking at sleep apnea and snoring with this little piece of tape.
How do you use breathing when you find yourself in a bad mood for no particular reason?
Well, it depends. You know, if I'm stressed and I notice I'm breathing too much, I will stop and breathe slowly. If I want a little boost of energy, I'll breathe quickly. So it's interesting to note that if ever you want to go to sleep, start extending your exhales more. That's going to greatly relax your body. And if you want a boost of energy, start inhaling more and exhaling a shorter amount of time. Because each of those things are going to stimulate the nervous system in any ways. And I think it's fascinating that we have these dials within us that we can just turn on and turn off. And if you really want to get stressed out and then really relaxed, you can try these vigorous pranayamas or the Wim Hof method, which is, by the way, Wim Hof did not make up this breathing technique. It has been around for at least a thousands of years. And people have been using it and having these benefits for a long time. So this stuff is really open to anybody.
You're listening to the best of Think 2020. I'm Chris Boyd. Is it safe and okay to learn this from a book or from a YouTube video? Do people need sort of professional guidance? Could it be dangerous to practice a different kind of breathing if we don't quite know what we're doing?
I cannot ever imagine that breathing slowly and breathing healthily and allowing the body to enter a state of coherence could ever be dangerous. And, you know, breathing through the nose is never going to be dangerous. I mean, this is how your body wants to breathe. Another benefit of nasal breathing is it releases a huge profusion of a molecule called nitric oxide, which is the exact molecule right now being administered to patients with severe symptoms of COVID to help them recover. Well, we produce our own. We produce it in our nose. And if we breathe through our nose, we're going to get much more NO than we would breathing through our mouths. So again, like what I've tried to focus on in the middle of the book was these are breathing practices anyone can do. They're going to be breathing slowly, breathing focused breaths, big exhale, breathing less. Like these are things that anyone can benefit from. The Wim Hof stuff and the vigorous TUMOs, that's a little more advanced. You know, those are for people who want to go up that next rung. But those basic principles of breathing, I really think anyone can really benefit from.
What did you learn about athletes using breath work to improve their performance?
That same reason, I thought this was so interesting, and I couldn't believe that no one else had stumbled upon this, but that same researcher in the 1950s who helped singers, who helped emphysemics, was asked in 1968 to train the runners of the track team, the U.S. men's track team, because the Olympics that year were going to be held in Mexico City, which has an elevation of 6,500 feet, 7,000 feet. And so these people needed to get fit. So he used that same diaphragmatic breathing practice, taught these runners how to breathe this way. They went out, started breaking personal bests, national records. They went down to the Olympics, destroyed everybody, came in number. I still think to this date, it was the greatest showing of any track team ever. And they were the only team not to use oxygen before or after their competitions because they didn't have to, because they knew how to breathe properly. So just looking at that, I thought was fascinating. And right now, breathing therapists, sports trainers are getting so into breathing. I've talked to several of them. They said, this has been the missing link we're looking for. You can increase your VO2 max by breathing properly. You can build blood, which allows you a much better, further endurance. I mean, you can recover in half the time, on and on and on. And what so many people don't realize is they think if they can run a marathon, they're breathing right and they're being healthy. But so many times they aren't. So you can benefit so much more from really focusing on your breath and knowing how to do it right.
The last time you and I talked, it was about your book about free divers, these people who go down under the water and spend many, many minutes holding their breath. Did that lead you to this?
It did in some ways. I had my own experiences breathing that no doctor or medical professional could really had an explanation for. And then I was able to talk to these free divers who demonstrated what was supposed to be scientifically impossible. The human body's not supposed to be able to go down past 100 feet. These people are going down 300, 400 feet every day. And what was interesting about them is these were regular folks. They were tall, they were small, they were large, they were skinny, you know, whatever. And they willed themselves to expand their lung capacity and be able to do something scientifically impossible. And I thought, wow, if the benefits of breathing allow us to dive so deep for so long, what can it do for the rest of us here on dry land? And it turned out a whole bunch of stuff, you know, from straightening spines to healing autoimmune diseases. And it's been just such a fascinating journey through this world.
Quick question before we go from Zika via email. For runners, is it better to breathe through the nose or the mouth to get the best oxygen?
Always breathe through the nose. And I know that that's going to be very hard for a lot of runners. As they say, you know, air is air. Doesn't matter. It matters so much. You can look up the work by John Duyar, who did a bunch of studies in the 90s showing the difference in endurance and recovery. Or Phil Maffetone has done a bunch of research in this. And Stanford is starting to do some research into this as well. So also, Sanya Richards-Ross, the greatest runner for 10 years, greatest sprinter, habitual nose breather. And to me, the pictures are proof when you watch her at the finish line, breathing through her nose calmly, all of her the competition way behind her, gasping from their mouths. So 20% more oxygen is a huge gain. So sometimes it takes, the reason why so many joggers give up on this is after a few weeks, they still can't breathe through their nose. But the more you stick to it, the easier it's going to get.
That was my conversation with journalist James Nestor, who joined me in May to talk about his book, Breath, The New Science of a Lost Art. If you liked this conversation, take a listen to all of our Best of Think 2020 shows. You can find those conversations at our website, think.kera.org. You can like our page on Facebook. We're also on Twitter. Our handle is @KERAThink. And subscribe to our podcast free wherever you get podcasts. Just search for KERA Think. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.